He was unable, even with the help of Turkish forces, to recapture the land which he had lost to Safari. His weakness offered the Samanids the chance to do some empire building of their own. In 892, the Samanid ruler Nasr I died, and his brother Ismail, who for some years had been the actual power behind the Samanid throne, took control. He established his own military headquarters in the city of Bukhara and began to expand his control across Khorasan. Now the far reaches of the Abbasid Empire had been chiseled away to almost nothing. Instead, the emirs of two independent dynasties, the Safarids and the Samanids, claimed the east. Back in Baghdad, the parade of caliphs through the throne room continued. Al-Mutamid was succeeded in turn by his nephew's half-Turkish son, and the son's son. The names of the caliphs are irrelevant, since power during that quarter century was held by the royal guard and the court officials. The post of senior vizier, literally helper to the caliph, accumulated more and more power, until the vizier's authority was as great as any caliph's of the past. With the complete abdication of any real Abbasid authority at Baghdad, a gash opened across the fractured surface of the Islamic lands. In the westward lands of northern Africa, known generally to Muslims as the Maghreb, Shia Muslims had been gathering in greater and greater numbers. These Shia Muslims were a particularly militant community. For some decades, the Shia had been divided by arguments over the legitimacy of the Imam. All of them agreed that there should be a designated Imam leading the Prophet's people, but figuring out exactly who had been designated had proved unexpectedly difficult. All Shia agreed that the designated line of Shia Imams began with Ali himself, and continued on with his sons, his grandson, his great-grandson, and his great-great-grandson, Ja'far al-Sadiq. Author's note. In Shia doctrine, Ali was followed by his son Hassan ibn Ali, who lived from 625 to 670, his second son Hussein ibn Ali, 626 to 680, Hussein's son Ali ibn Hussein, also known as Zayn al-Abidin, 654 to 713, Ali's son Muhammad ibn Ali, also known as Muhammad al-Bakir, 676 to 743, and Muhammad's son Ja'far ibn Muhammad, also known as Ja'far al-Sadiq, 702 to 765. After Ja'far, the Shia party split, and two different lines of descent were traced from Ja'far. The Twelvers, the majority group, believed that the rightful imams were descended from Ja'far's younger son, Musa, and recognized 12 imams in total, ending with Musa's descendant, Muhammad ibn Hassan, who disappeared when he was 10 and who, they believe, will one day return. The Ismailis insisted on descent from Ja'far's oldest son, Ismail. A third and smaller group of Shia, the Zayids, recognize Ali and his sons as true successors to the Prophet, but hold that later Imams can come from any descendant of those two sons. At that point, the Shia had an internal argument. The largest group of Shia Muslims insisted that the rightful Imams were descended from Ja'far's younger son, Musa, and a smaller group claimed that Ja'far's older son, Ismail, had instead been the heir to his power. This smaller group, the Ismailis, were inclined to be more aggressive and warlike in pressing their claims than their Shia brothers. From North Africa, they had been watching the charade at Baghdad play itself out. And in 909, the Ismailis offered a candidate of their own for the caliphate, Ubaidallah al-Mandi, who claimed to be a descendant not only of Ismail, but also, tracing his ancestry back a few more generations, of Ismail's great-great-great-grandmother Fatima, the Prophet's daughter. Al-Mandi did not simply make himself emir, like the leaders of the Safarids and Samanids. Instead, he proclaimed himself caliph in the Maghreb. This North African caliphate, the Fatimid caliphate, was a direct challenge to the authority of the Abbasids. Until this point, all of the fragments of the Islamic Empire had been painted the same color. Even the Umayyad emir in Al-Andalus had declined to call himself a caliph. Even the Safarid and Samanid rebels had paid lip service to the Abbasid caliphate. But now, 300 years after Muhammad, the Islamic world had cracked irreparably in two. The Islamic Empire had been a convenient myth for over a century. Now it was not even possible to speak of it. There was no empire based on religion in the East, any more than in the West, simply a collection of nations and states, each fighting for survival. Chapter 60. The Great Army of the Vikings. Between 865 and 878, Alfred of Wessex makes peace with the Vikings by dividing his island with them. In 865, a detachment of the Vikings who had been pillaging the lands of the Franks sailed back away from the fortified bridges of Charles the Landless and followed the sea to easier country. Across the water from western Francia lay the island of Britain, covered with an uneasy network of kings and war leaders. Since Roman times, Pictish tribes in the north had struggled with the Scoti, pirates from the western island of Ireland, who had landed on the cold mountainous shores and rooted themselves in. Farther south, seven Anglo-Saxon kings divided up the English countryside. Author's note, the seven English kingdoms that dominated in the 9th century were Northumbria, Mercia, East Anglia, Essex, Kent, Sussex, and Wessex. The craggy southwestern coasts remained in the hands of the Welsh, descendants of the Romans and Irish and native Britons who had settled there since the days of the 4th century Roman general Magnus Maximus. Between the central kingdom of Mercia and the kingdom of Wales lay a massive fortification built by the 8th century Mercian king Offa, a great ditch in front of a 20-foot wall of earth. The Welsh devastated the territory of Offa, says the 13th century Chronicle of the Princes, and then Offa caused a dike to be made as a boundary between him and Wales. It extends from one sea to another. The previous century had seen several attempts at unification. Some 20 years before the Viking invasion of Britain, Cinaid Mac Alpin, ruler of the Scoti kingdom Dalriata on the northwestern coast, attacked the Picts to his east. He folded their land into his own, creating a kingdom that stretched across the north. Cinaid Mac Alpin was later known as Kenneth Mac Alpin, or Kenneth I, the first king of Scotland. His dynasty, the House of Alpin, ruled over this united northern kingdom from the city of Scone. In the south, the Mercian kings who came after Offa had managed to dominate the eastern kingdoms of Kent and East Anglia for a time, but both soon broke away. By 860, Mercia had declined in power and Wessex had ascended. The King of Wessex had annexed both Kent and Sussex, and the southeast of England was more or less united under a single throne. But there was still no high king who could pull the divided Anglo-Saxon forces together in resistance to the Vikings. The Vikings, who arrived in 865, landed in Wessex. They were under the command of three brothers, Halfdan, Ivar, and Ubba, sons of the Viking pirate Ragnar Lodbrok himself. The oldest brother, Ivar, was known as Ivar the Boneless. He may have been the victim of a bone disease that weakened his legs. All we know for certain is that he was often carried on a shield into battle, where he fought with a long spear. His arriving hordes flew the raven banner, the symbol of the god Odin. Odin, king of battles, could blind and deafen his foes. He could still the sea and turn winds to give victory. He could awaken the dead, and his two ravens flew over the land and brought him intelligence of his enemies. It is told, wrote the 9th-century Welsh monk John Asser, that the three sisters of Ivar and Ubba wove that banner and completed it entirely between dawn and dusk on a single day. Moreover, they say that in every battle in which that banner goes before them, the raven in the midst of the design seems to flutter as though it were alive, if they were destined to gain the day. But if they were about to be conquered, it would droop down without moving, and this has often been proved to be true. The raven banner was more than a standard. It was a sign of the ancient religions whose power still lingered in the memories of the Christian Anglo-Saxons. England had been officially Christian since 664, when the Northumbrian king Oswiu called a council at the monastery of Whitby, and announced that his kingdom would join the rest of the Christian world in one rule of life, and the celebration of the holy sacraments. But the faith itself had spread unevenly. As long as the country remained a quilt of independent political allegiances, 9th-century Christians carried out their devotion separately, with the old British religion still practiced in the mountains and crags of Wales, in the deep patches of forest that lay between villages, in the darkness that surrounded the struggling churches of Wessex and Mercia and Northumbria. In the old English epic, Beowulf, which reflects a 9th-century world, a Christian king and his warriors live on top of a well-lit hill, but a monster prowls through the tangled swamp below, a demon, a kinsman of Cain, an enemy of God. He haunts the glittering hall, attacking at night to drag the warriors away into the heathen darkness. These were hard times, the poet writes. The threat of the monster's attack even drove the warriors back to pagan shrines, where they made offerings to the old gods in hopes of deliverance. That was their way, the poet writes. their heathenish hope. Deep in their hearts, they remembered hell. By the time Beowulf was written down, a century or so later, the Vikings were rooted deeply into the Anglo-Saxon countryside, and the Christian king was himself of Viking blood. But in 865, the Viking invaders, the great army of the Vikings, were part of a hellish attack. Warriors from the old world, with the gods' demons on their banners, their victory would not merely deprive the Anglo-Saxons of land, it would pull them back into the dark waters of the ancient religions. Ivar the Boneless and his men first landed in East Anglia, where their overwhelming might forced the East Anglian king into quick agreement. In exchange for keeping his throne, he would provide food and shelter over the winter and horses in the spring. The great army spent the winter of 865 in their East Anglian haven, and when the worst of the cold was over, began the march north into Northumbria. Northumbria had been divided by civil war between two men who claimed the throne, but at the Viking approach they gave up their struggle, united their forces, and turned together to face the new threat. Their cooperation was too little too late. By the end of 867, the great army had overrun Northumbria, taken York, and laid waste to the monastery at Whitby. It would lie wrecked and ruined for the next 200 years. An immense slaughter was made of the Northumbrians, the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle tells us, and the same raiding army then went into Mercia. The King of Mercia sent to his neighbour, King Ethelred of Wessex, for help. Ethelred, who also controlled Sussex and Kent, answered the call. Together with his younger brother Alfred, now about 20 years old, serving as Ethelred's second in command, King Ethelred came to meet the Vikings at Nottingham, and there arranged a temporary peace. No heavy fight occurred there, the chronicle says, and the Mercians made peace, and the raiding army went back to York and stayed there 1 year. Probably Ethelred and Alfred paid the Vikings off. In exchange for saving Mercia, young Alfred got the daughter of the Mercian king as his wife, which essentially promised him the kingdom of Mercia at some point down the line. At the end of that year, having regathered their strength and restocked their provisions, the Vikings went back into East Anglia, killed the king who had provided them with winter quarters, and took it for themselves. Now the soldiers were masters of the north and part of the east, and Wessex itself was in danger. The great army marched into Wessex during the winter, in January of 871. Ethelred and Alfred braced themselves for the attack, but despite their resistance, the Vikings moved steadily westward into Ethelred's kingdom. On January 4th, the Anglo-Saxon army was defeated at Reading in Sussex. They retreated and retrenched. 4 days later, they met the great army again at Ashdown. This time they were able to push the Vikings back, but Ethelred's army was seriously weakened by the victory. There were many thousands killed, and fighting went on until night, the chronicle tells us. 2 weeks later, the tide turned back towards the Vikings, and in another enormous clash at the southern town of Basing, the great army was victorious. Halfdan took over the rule of London, and Viking reinforcements arrived to swell the great army's ranks. Although Ethelred continued to resist, he died of illness in April, aged 30. Alfred, now in his early 20s, inherited the kingship of Wessex, the command of the struggling Anglo-Saxon army, and the unenviable task of meeting the great army in battle. He was a great warrior and victorious in virtually all battles, wrote his contemporary John Asser. This is clearly hindsight, since Alfred promptly lost another fight against the great army and was forced to make a temporary peace treaty. Meanwhile, the Vikings firmed up their dominance in Northumbria, and then in 874 moved back into Mercia and took the kingdom for their own. At some point during these months of battle, Ivar the Boneless died, but the Vikings continued strong, led by Ivar's brother Ubba. Halfdan had fallen out of favour with his followers, thanks to his ruthlessness, and by Ubba's lieutenant, the warrior chief Guthrum. It seemed to be only a matter of time before the entire island fell into Viking hands, so Alfred, in command of an exhausted and ravaged army, went into hiding. He had watched Ethelred fight battle after battle at the cost of thousands of lives, and could see no future in continuing a war of attrition. By 878, Anglo-Saxon refugees were sailing away from the island, looking in desperation for new homes. The Vikings were camped firmly on the Avon, and Alfred and his men were far out of sight, living in the swamps of Athelney in Alfred's Wessex kingdom. He led a restless life in great distress, amid the woody and marshy places, writes Asser, with nothing to live on except what he could forage by frequent raids from the Vikings. All was not yet lost. He was not the only general leading attacks against the Vikings. In early 878, Ivar's brother Ubba was killed in the Battle of Canute, possibly on his way to try to flush out Alfred's army. The Anglo-Saxon forces were led in this fight by the nobleman Odda, a Saxon ealdorman, or alderman, a dux who governed in the king's name, who not only triumphed over the Vikings, but also captured the Raven Banner, the sign of Odin's power. Perhaps this good omen heartened Alfred, but he didn't come out of hiding. Guthrum was still at the great army's head, and the Vikings were still in control of the countryside. Alfred had decided to take the long view. He was willing to risk the kingdom so that he could build up his fighting force. Stories would later multiply around this self-imposed exile, including the most famous tale of all. Alfred, hiding out incognito in the hut of an Athelney cowherd, was told by the housewife to watch the cakes baking on the hearth. Preoccupied with thoughts of his war against the Vikings, he ignored the cakes when they began to burn, and the housewife came storming back into the hut. "You're anxious enough to eat them when they're hot," she scolded. "Why can't you turn them when they're burning?" This story was inserted by the 16th-century clergyman Matthew Parker, who claims that it was found in a 9th-century source. It probably arose later, but its essence tells us something about the memory of Alfred, who humbly turns the cakes and doesn't reveal to the housewife that she has just told off the King of England. Even his contemporaries saw him as virtuous and holy, a God-provided deliverance from the pagan threat, which is why John Asser characterized him as victorious, even when he was losing, and why the later chronicler Simeon of Durham insisted that his face shone like an angel's, and that his armor was faith, hope, and the love of God. Theological conviction can founder in the face of defeat, though, and Alfred kept his place in the pantheon of divinely appointed rulers by emerging from the Athelney marshes with a strong and desperate army behind him. In the late spring of 878, he met the great army of the Vikings at the Wessex town of Eddington and triumphed. Fighting fiercely with a compact shield wall, Asser writes, he persevered resolutely for a long time. At length, he gained the victory through God's will. He destroyed the Vikings with great slaughter and pursued those who fled. After the battle at Eddington, the Viking chief Guthrum agreed not only to sign a treaty with Alfred, but also to convert to Christianity. He brought 30 of his strongest warriors with him, and all of them were baptized on the same day. Afterwards, they retreated to their own land. The agreement signed by Alfred and Guthrum, the Treaty of Wedmore, divided England in two. The south and southwest remained in Anglo-Saxon hands. Alfred ruled the southern lands and placed the rule of the shrunken Mercian kingdom in the hands of his daughter and son-in-law, who governed it under his supervision. Guthrum and his Vikings were awarded independent control of Northumbria, the eastern coast, and the eastern half of Mercia. Alfred's victory at Eddington may have been decisive, but the Vikings had suffered greater defeats without surrender. The truth was that the Viking troops, once raiders and havoc-makers, had now been in England for almost 15 years. They had rooted themselves into the English countryside, married Anglo-Saxon women, fathered children, planted farms, and lost a little of their piratical edge. They had begun to feel like natives, not invaders. They were ready to start new lives, and they were willing to accept the new faith if that would give them their farms and families, and Alfred's men were no less anxious to go back to their fields, their wives, and their lives. In the years after Wedmore, Alfred was forced to put down several Viking attempts to seize more land for themselves, but the division of England into two kingdoms, the Anglo-Saxons and the Danelaw, would stand. The Treaty of Wedmore was a compromise, but it gave everyone what they wanted. Guthrum and the Viking warlords got a new home. Alfred was able to lay claim to the greatest Anglo-Saxon kingdom yet, a southern realm he could pass on to his son Edward. And Alfred's followers, the exhausted and war-beaten Anglo-Saxons of Wessex and Mercia, were finally permitted to return to their old, barely remembered lives. It was for this that Alfred was remembered with gratitude. He was both conqueror and peacemaker. Renowned, warlike, victorious, the zealous supporter of widows, orphans, and the poor, the 12th-century historian John of Worcester concluded, most dear to his people, gracious to all, he awaits the garment of blessed immortality and the glory of the resurrection with the just. Chapter 61. Struggle for the Iron Crown. Between 875 and 899, Charles the Landless buys the title Emperor of the Romans. Charles the Fat inherits the entire empire by chance, and the Magyars arrive in northern Italy. In 875, Charles the Landless became Emperor of the Romans by the most direct method possible. He offered Pope John VIII a huge bribe. The chroniclers agree that John crowned him on Christmas Day in exchange for dona pecunia multa et preciosa munera. This infuriated Louis the German, who thought that the title should have come to him. Their older brother Lothair had died in 855, leaving his son Louis II the Younger as King of Italy and Emperor of the Romans. Louis II had died earlier in 875, and Louis the German, the oldest Frankish king left, had expected to be the next emperor. He was now 69 years old. He had seen the title passed to brother and nephew, and he wanted the imperium for himself. Apparently it hadn't occurred to him to pay for it, but now that the coronation was over, all he could do was take revenge. While Charles the Landless was still in Rome, Louis the German stormed into his western Frankish lands, destroying and burning in fury. Charles hurried back home, but before the brothers could face off, Louis the German died. A lifetime of frustrated ambition had come to a sudden end. Shortly afterward, Charles the Landless died of sudden illness. His son and heir, Louis the Stammerer, barely survived him by 2 years. The complicated mass of Frankish kingdoms devolved onto the surviving heirs. Louis the German's two sons, Carloman and Louis the Younger, Louis III, divided the eastern Frankish realms between them. But when Carloman had a stroke, his lands passed on to his younger brother Charles the Fat, who was already ruling in Italy. The western Frankish kingdom was ruled jointly by Charles the Landless's two grandsons. The Frankish kings negotiated and jousted for position. In 881, the Pope decided to crown Charles the Fat of Italy as the Emperor of the Romans. This had less to do with Charles, who was not much of a warrior, than with the fact that he was technically in control of Italy. The Pope was worried that the Papal States might come under attack from one of his neighbours, Guy, the ambitious Duke of Spoleto. If the Pope were to invest any other Frankish king with the title of Emperor, Charles might not allow him to come into Italy in defence of the Pope, even though that was the purpose of the title. Charles accepted the title of Emperor, but after his coronation he never returned to southern Italy again, and certainly never bothered to help the Papal States against Guy of Spoleto's raids. But despite his disinterest, Charles the Fat, originally a younger brother with no chance of inheriting anything for himself, was soon not only Emperor of the Romans, but the most powerful monarch in the West. In 882, two of the Frankish kings died of separate natural causes. In 884, the third was killed while hunting. All of these realms, one at a time, were added to the kingdom of the remaining legitimate heir, Charles the Fat. Chance and fate had managed to reunite the old empire and title of Charlemagne under a single king, with the sole exception of the territory of Provence, which had rebelled and declared itself independent. Author's note: Aquitaine had been reunited to the western Frankish lands and now fell under Charles the Fat's rule as well. What Louis the German had failed to do in a lifetime of fighting, negotiating, and sweating blood, Charles the Fat had gained without lifting a finger. But gaining and keeping were two different things, and Charles the Fat, weak and inept, with no legitimate son or heir and no plans for ruling his enormous new empire, almost immediately ran into trouble. In 885, the year after the entire empire had fallen under his rule, he began to have increased trouble with Vikings. They had been raiding his lands on a regular basis, but he had generally managed to buy them off with silver and, occasionally, hostages. Now the invasions grew more severe. Not all of the great army of the Vikings had settled in England. Some of the warriors, not liking the idea of farming, had made their way back to the mainland to resume their life of raiding. They had also branched out from raiding by ship. Now they were apt to land horses on the coasts and thunder across the countryside on horseback, raiding and killing in a much wider swath. "The Northmen do not cease capturing and killing the Christian people," lamented a Frankish monk, "destroying churches, demolishing fortifications, and burning towns. Everywhere there are only corpses of priests, laymen, whether noble or not, women, young people, suckling babes. There is no road, there is no place where the ground is not strewn with corpses." Charles the Fat seemed entirely unable to stop the raids. He assembled an army that marched against the Vikings at the city of Louvain, where the Franks were badly defeated. Victorious, the Vikings captured the city of Rouen, then organized a massive invasion up the Seine. 700 ships sailed up to the walls of Paris and laid siege to the city. Charles, who was far away from Paris at the time, sent an army which failed to lift the siege. In desperation, he offered the Vikings 700 pounds of silver and winter quarters in Burgundy in exchange for their retreat. The Vikings agreed to the bargain and lifted the siege of Paris, but Charles the Fat had lost whatever sympathy his people still had for him. They were furious. If he were going to hand over their tax money instead of driving the invaders away, why hadn't he done so at the beginning of the siege and spared them a great deal of trouble? The Burgundians, particularly annoyed by the cavalier offer of their homeland, revolted. Charles's nephew, Arnulf of Carinthia, raised an army, and in 887 he marched into the Frankish territory to remove his uncle by force. In the face of all this hostility, Charles the Fat agreed to give up his titles as king and emperor. His willingness to surrender may have had something to do with his health. He had been suffering from a serious condition in his skull, even undergoing trepanning in an attempt to relieve his pain. In January of 888, just months after his abdication, Charles the Fat died. The empire disintegrated into even smaller pieces than before, and a scramble for the title of Emperor of the Romans began. Arnulf of Carinthia became the king of Eastern Francia. Two Italian noblemen, Berengar of Friuli and Guy of Spoleto, the same Duke of Spoleto who had been threatening to trouble the Papal States, began to quarrel over the right to become King of Italy. Five different noblemen claimed other parts of the empire. Author's note. Arnulf of Carinthia became King of Eastern Francia and Lotharingia. Odo was elected King of Western Francia. Guy of Spoleto and Berengar fought over Italy. Louis, son of the Provence nobleman Bosso, was acclaimed in Provence. In Upper Burgundy, a nobleman named Rudolf was made king. Ranulf II made himself king of Aquitaine, and also announced that Charles the Simple, youngest son of Louis the Stammerer, and now 9 years old, was the rightful king of Western Francia. As though bereft of a legitimate heir, writes the chronicler Regino of Prum, the kingdoms that had obeyed him no longer waited for a ruler given by nature, but each chose to create for itself a king from its own innards. This situation sparked tremendous warring. In such chaos, the Pope, Stephen V, protected his own interests. He declared Guy of Spoleto King of Italy and crowned him in 891 as Emperor. This bore the earmarks of a deal, the papal sanction and the title of Emperor, in exchange for Guy's agreeing to leave the Papal States alone. It was, perhaps, not exactly what Charlemagne had meant when he declared that the Emperor of the Romans had the responsibility of protecting the Pope. After only 3 years as Emperor of the Romans, Guy of Spoleto died unexpectedly, intending his 14-year-old son, Lambert, to succeed him as King of Italy. An elegant youth, writes the historian Liutprand of Cremona, and, though still an adolescent, quite warlike. Berengar of Friuli, who had not given up hope of becoming King of Italy, was still causing trouble in the north. He at once advanced to the city of Pavia and declared himself rival king. In the midst of all this, the Pope Stephen V's successor, Formosus, sent a message to Arnulf of Carinthia, now king of Eastern Francia, and promised him the title emperor if he would come down and restore peace. To Formosus's mind, his predecessor had overstepped himself by granting the honour to a random Italian warrior, rather than to a king from the family of Charlemagne. Arnulf of Carinthia, Carolingian by birth, was the obvious candidate for the position. Arnulf agreed, and in 896 finished the long journey to Rome at the head of his army. Lambert, hearing of the Frankish king's approach, had fled to his father's old homeland, Spoleto. Arnulf allowed Formosus to declare him not only king of Eastern Francia, but also king of Italy and emperor of the Romans, and then began to march towards Spoleto to deal with Lambert. But on the short journey between Rome and Spoleto, he suffered from a stroke which partly paralyzed him. Abruptly, he gave up the plan to defeat Lambert and returned home. Lambert emerged from Spoleto and reclaimed the title King of Italy, but before he could get to Rome and punish Formosus, the Pope died. Lambert barely allowed this to stop him. With adolescent outrage, he ordered Formosus's successor, Stephen VI, to open Formosus's casket. The dead Pope was dressed in vestments and set behind a table, and Stephen VI convened a synod of churchmen to condemn and defrock the body. Once these things were done, writes Liutprand of Cremona, he ordered the corpse, stripped of its holy vestments, and with three fingers cut off, to be tossed into the Tiber. The fingers were those with which Formosus had blessed the people of Rome. The synod itself was labelled later as the Synodus Horrenda, the trial of the cadaver. With his feelings relieved, Lambert marched back up north and made a deal with Berengar. Lambert would rule the southern lands of Italy, Berengar could govern the north, and Lambert would seal the deal by marrying Berengar's daughter, Gisella. Berengar agreed. He probably had no intention of keeping to the terms of the deal, but he had no chance to violate it. Just months later, at the age of 18, Lambert broke his neck. Liutprand of Cremona wrote, in the first draft of his history, that Lambert was out hunting boars and fell off his horse. Later, he revised his draft to add, "There is another account which seems to me more likely." In the second version of events, Lambert had been murdered by a young man from Milan, whose father had been executed, and the assassin had then arranged the body so that a hunting accident would be suspected instead. However it happened, the death allowed Berengar to announce himself as king of all Italy. But although he had finally grasped his crown, an evil coincidence was about to remove it. To his north, a storm was gathering. Once again a warrior had united separate tribes into a nascent nation. This time the tribes were Finno-Ugrian, like the peoples among whom the Rus had settled. The warrior's name was Arpad, and he had created an alliance in which he was the first king. Before this Arpad, they had never at any time had any other prince, wrote the Byzantine emperor, Constantine Porphyrogenitus, in his History of the Magyars. Under Arpad, soldiers of the Magyar alliance began to move westward. Around 895, they had arrived at the edge of Moravia. In 898, they attacked Venice, but then retreated. But in 899, just as Berengar claimed the Iron Crown of the Lombards, they advanced towards the north of Italy. They had been encouraged to do so. Arnulf of Carinthia, back in eastern Francia, had offered them clothing and money if they would direct their energies towards northern Italy. Arnulf had been forced to give up the conquest of Italy, but he had not given up hope of removing his competitors. Berengar and his army fought back, but the Magyars were fresh, hungry, and hard to defeat. They were also experts at guerrilla warfare, and for the next year they sacked Italian towns and retreated before Berengar's men could catch up with them. Berengar began to lose the support of the Italian noblemen, who had been willing to support his rule. If he could not get rid of the Magyars, what use was he? Led by a northern Italian duke named Adalbert, whose lands had been hit hard by the Magyars, the noblemen invited a minor Carolingian prince, Louis of Provence, great-great-great-grandson of Charlemagne on his mother's side, to come into Italy and take up the Iron Crown. Berengar put up a token fight, but his army had shrunk, and Louis of Provence's supporters were increasing in number. Berengar was forced to flee from northern Italy, leaving the Iron Crown in the hands of his rival and the Magyars victorious in his wake. Chapter 62. Campacu. Between 884 and 940, the Fujiwara create a new position for themselves, and the heavenly sovereign Uda tries and fails to break Fujiwara power. By 884, the Fujiwara official Mototsune was the most powerful man in Japan. He had been Sessho, regent, for the child emperor Yose, and in 881 he was appointed prime minister as well. Now, with Yose well into his teens and capable of claiming rule for himself, Mototsune invented a new title for himself. He would be Kampaku, or civil dictator, a sort of super-advisor to the crown. It was a title that allowed him to have almost the same amount of power over a grown emperor as a Sessho had held over the underage ruler. Meanwhile, the 15-year-old Yose, who had been a crowned and idle sovereign for 10 years, was mutating from bored child into budding psychopath. He had developed a fondness for watching dogs kill monkeys and feeding frogs to snakes. He had also begun to suggest that he should carry out the execution of criminals with his own hands. Mototsune took advantage of this troubling behavior and called a council of palace officials, all of whom agreed with him that the young emperor should be dethroned. The Kampaku then lured his heavenly sovereign into a carriage, promising him a visit to the races, and whisked him out of the city. In his place, the court acclaimed his great-uncle, the 54-year-old heavenly sovereign Koko. Yose was never imprisoned. His psychopathy took an occasional downward turn. He was reputedly responsible for at least 2 murders, but he seems to have been allowed to roam through the mountains on horseback, hunting and sleeping out, and sometimes appearing without warning at the gates of one or another great landowner, demanding to be let in. He fell in love at least once and wrote a poem to the woman he desired, its imagery drawn from the remote northeastern coast, where the Mina River plunged from the 3,000-foot Mount Tsukuba into a boiling pool. The Mina stream comes tumbling down from Mount Tsukuba's height. Strong as my love, it leaps into a pool as black as night with overwhelming might. There is no record that he ever married. Back in Heian, Heavenly Sovereign Koko paid no attention to politics. Morotsune remained as Kampaku, keeping the reins of the government completely in his own hands. For the first time, the Kampaku openly ruled for an emperor who was an adult at the time of his coronation. It was a turning point in the development of this office, which had never been officially created or sanctioned, and which owed its existence to the ambition and energy of a single family. And Motatsune's unquestioned dominance continued for another 3 years, until Koko died. He was succeeded by his 21-year-old son, Heavenly Sovereign Uda, who immediately began a careful but determined campaign to get real power back from his prime minister. On the death of the Emperor Koko, Mototsune had offered his ceremonial resignation as Kampaku, something that had become, like the resignation of all White House staff at the end of an American presidency, a standard gesture in Japanese politics. Uda was supposed to accept it and, in an equally standard gesture, reappoint Mototsune as his own Kampaku. Uda accepted the resignation, but then rebelled against the custom. He did not dare infuriate the powerful Fujiwara clan by neglecting to reappoint Mototsune altogether. Instead, he wrote a fulsome official letter to the older man, offering Mototsune the post not of Kampaku, but of Ako, or Supreme Minister, in the new administration. The title of Ako was old and respected, but largely ceremonial. Mototsune was so furious that he went on strike. He was still Prime Minister after all, and as long as he refused to sign papers or answer petitions, the business of the court ground to a halt. For nearly a year, Heavenly Sovereign Uda resisted the growing pressure from his other officials to pacify Mototsune by giving him back the title of Kampaku. Government business grew more and more snarled, and the scholars at court debated with increasing heat about whether or not the title Ako was an insult. "All affairs of government, great and small, have stagnated," Uda wrote in his diary. "All the provinces and all the ministries complain ceaselessly." Finally, in November of 888, Uda was forced to buckle. He blamed the offer of the post of Ako on his unfortunate secretary, the scholar Hiromi, saying that Hiromi had misunderstood his intentions and written the wrong title in the letter. This was about all the face-saving he could do. He was embarrassed. Hiromi's career was sharply curtailed, and Mototsune, with dignity, accepted the appointment as Kampaku and started signing papers again. He had proved that he, and not the Heavenly Sovereign, had the last word at court, but even Mototsune could not live forever. Some years before, the poet Arewara no Narihira, a man of royal blood, a distant relative of the Heavenly Sovereign Kamu, who had run afoul of the Fujiwara and had seen his chances of advancement at court go up in flames, had voiced the hope of Mototsune's enemies that old age and death would finally bring an end to Mototsune's lifelong grab for more power. "Scatter and cover, with clouds, cherry blossoms, that you may hide the path by which old age is said to approach." In 891, his hopes were realized. Mototsune, in the grip of worsening illness, resigned his position as Kampaku and died just a few weeks later. Mototsune's oldest son, Tokihira, was barely 21, and Uda refused to award him or anyone else the title of Kampaku. Instead, he left the post empty and appointed members of other clans to as many official positions as possible. He could not ignore Tokihira, but he gave the young man a junior post and put no reliance in him. His most trusted advisor was Sugawara no Michizane, a poet with an unimportant family background and a talent for scholarship. Michizane, who was in his 50s, had experience serving as governor in the provinces and had earned Uda's gratitude by coming out in support of the scapegoat secretary Hiromi during the earlier struggle with Mototsune. Uda's humiliation at Mototsune's hands made him wary of out-and-out defiance of Fujiwara expectations. Over the next 10 years, he promoted Mototsune's son through the ranks at court at a reasonable rate, but he also promoted Michizane with equal diligence. By 896, the two men held the two highest positions in his government. Meanwhile, the Heavenly Sovereign had been working hard to improve the relationship between the court at Heian and the outer provinces. Aware that the noblemen in the outer reaches of the kingdom were collecting taxes for the crown and then keeping them for themselves, he passed a series of reforms to prevent those noblemen from seizing the land of the peasants under their power, and then, when these reforms were well underway, he abdicated. He was 31, and the abdication was a risky and bold move. His oldest son, Daigo, had just turned 13 and could rule without the supervision of a seshō. By stepping down and allowing Daigo to be crowned as heavenly sovereign in his place, Uda could supervise the transfer of power. In any case, Uda had no intention of giving up his power. Although he went through the formal steps of putting off his royal robes, taking up the study of Buddhism, and applying for entrance to a monastery, he kept his hand in court politics so heavily that he became known as the Cloistered Emperor. His fight against Fujiwara power had not exactly been intended to restore the real political power of the heavenly sovereign. That position remained relatively passive, a vital but highly ceremonial connection between the people of Japan and the divine order. Instead, it had been a struggle to resist the overwhelming ambitions of a single family, and he had placed Michizane in the front lines of that battle. Michizane found the position uncomfortable. In 899, 2 years after Uda's abdication, he petitioned the young heavenly sovereign Daigo to be allowed to resign. He had got wind of a plot against him, led by Fujiwara no Tokihira, and he was frightened. Daigo, directed by his father, refused to accept the resignation. In 901, Tokihira struck. He convinced Daigo, who was, after all, not quite 17, and suffering the usual teenage anxieties, that his father was plotting with Michizane to remove him and place one of his brothers on the throne instead. Daigo was persuaded to issue an imperial decree, without notifying his father, that would exile Michizane from the capital city for life. As soon as the boy set his name to the decree, Tokihira ordered his rival and his family arrested and hauled off to the outer limits of the empire. As soon as the arrest was made, the cat was out of the bag. Officials loyal to Uda ran to the monastery where he lived and told him what was happening. Uda rode to the palace at once, but Tokihira had locked the doors. He was unable to get in and spent the night standing in the street. By morning, Michizane and his sons were already well out of Heian, on their way to exile on the southern island of Kyushu. Uda's gamble had failed, and Sugawara no Michizane paid the price. He died in exile 2 years later without ever returning to the capital. With young Daigo under his thumb, Tokihira began to make himself as powerful at court as his great father had been. He did not try to claim the title of Kampaku, but he once again filled the ranks of courtiers and officials with Fujiwara noblemen and their flunkies. Uda, in his monastery, was cut off from his son, from authority, and from the role he had hoped to play in the government of his country. Tokihira's rise was cut short by his premature death in 909, but his brother, Motatsune's younger son, Fujiwara no Tadahira, took over as his successor. When the heavenly sovereign Daigo died in 930, at age 46, the court elected Tadahira as seshō to the emperor's 7-year-old son. A year later, Uda also died, still in his monastery, still excluded from the palace. When the new heavenly sovereign, Suzaku, reached the age of responsibility, Tadahira claimed the post of Kampaku. He had regained his father's position, and once again the Fujiwara clan held almost every important post in Heian. The jostling for power in Heian did not erupt into assassination and civil war as it did in China, or in Byzantium, or in the kingdoms farther west. For one thing, the heavenly sovereign of Japan had no standing army. When the heavenly sovereign needed troops, they were drafted from the civilian population of free men older than 20 and younger than 60. Even these draftees lived, when not actually fighting, as on-call civilians. For the most part, they remained in their own homes, living in their own provinces, carrying on their regular lives as farmers and merchants, and generally giving no more than 35 or 40 days per year to military service. And so the Fujiwara, or other ambitious noblemen, did not have the option, so popular to the West, of pursuing a career as a general, gaining the army support, and using it to overthrow the sovereign. Author's note, the Japanese military structure was somewhat more complex than this brief summary allows me to describe. For a more detailed explanation, see Carl F. Friday, Hired Swords. What they could do was gain legislative power at court, like the Fujiwara, or else use their own private armies to control an outlying region, away from the capital city. In 939, A landowner named Taira no Masakado followed the second path. He lived in the fertile northeastern area known as the Kanto. He was skilled at fighting on horseback and ambitious for his family's honor, and he could boast descent from the Emperor Kamu himself. The men of his clan, the Taira, held various official positions in the Kanto, and Masakado himself had spent time at the court in Heian as a young man. There he had seen firsthand the power of the Fujiwara clan. The sight, perhaps, fired his ambition. His climb to power began as a local squabble. On his return home from the Heian court, Masakado quarreled with several of his neighbors over land rights, and the quarrel escalated into a fight. The armed retainers of the battling landowners began a small local war, which tipped Masakado's way. Encouraged by his success, Masakado directed his private army, now numbering over 1,000 men, to follow him in attacking the nearest provincial governor, the royal official in charge of the province of Hitachi. The governor's office, not designed to hold off an army, surrendered quickly. Masakado, even more impressed by his own might, declared himself to be a monarch in his own right, the new emperor. He captured the surrounding royal outposts as well and started to appoint court officials of his own to help run them. But his rule lasted only 3 months. Tadahira ordered a price put on his head. The heavenly sovereign didn't have a standing army, but he had plenty of money. 2 other great landowners, one of them a Fujiwara and the other a member of Masakado's own clan, banded together to fight against the new emperor and claimed the reward. 3 months after Masakado had crowned himself, his 2 opponents descended on the northern border of his captured territory with their own private troops. Masakado's army, like all the other armies in Japan, was in flux. The men who served him were not full-time soldiers, and they tended to come and go so that they could take care of their private lives. At the moment of attack, it had temporarily shrunk to about 400 men. The tiny force was wiped out and Masakado was killed. "His horse forgot how to gallop as the wind in flight," says the Shomonki, the contemporary history of his revolt, "and the man lost his martial skills. Struck by an arrow from the gods, in the end the new emperor perished alone." Masakado's armed revolt was the unruly provincial version of the Fujiwara grab for power in the center of the kingdom. It was less successful than the sophisticated political maneuvering in Heian, but it was a foretaste of things to come. For the next century, the Fujiwara would continue to dominate in their hereditary semi-legal dictatorship, but their power would not go unchallenged. The heavenly sovereign had been slowly boxed into a smaller and smaller space, and outside that space the aristocratic families of Japan fought for power with increasing ferocity. Chapter 63. Basileus. Between 886 and 927, Leo the Wise defies the Patriarch of Constantinople, the Bulgarian king demands the title of emperor, and Romanus Lecapenus explains that Christians should not fight wars. Leo VI, legal son of Basil I, was 20 when he became sole emperor of Constantinople. Almost at once, he began to earn himself the nickname Leo Sophos, or Leo the Wise. The title did not necessarily suggest enormous skill in government. It meant something more like Leo the Bookish. Leo read widely, had a prodigious memory, and occupied his evenings by writing military manuals, revising legal codes, composing hymns and poems, and preparing sermons, which he delivered on feast days and special occasions. He was not the first emperor to preach sermons. His predecessor Leo III had given a whole series of anti-icon homilies, but Leo the Wise had his hands in church affairs up to the elbows. The theologian Arethas of Caesarea called him Theosophos, wise in the things of God, which may be a code phrase for meddler in sacred things. He had barely come to the throne when he decided to replace the patriarch, the senior churchman in Constantinople, with his own 19-year-old brother, Stephen, and after Stephen's death, he appointed the next 2 patriarchs on his own authority as well. The second of these patriarchs, the monk Nicholas Mystikos, proved less malleable than Leo the Wise intended. By 901, Leo had to face the unpleasant truth that the succession to the throne was in danger. At nearly 40, he had married 3 times, but he had not managed to father a son. In fact, he had been forced to crown his brother Alexander as co-emperor and heir. He had not given up hope, though. When his 3rd wife died in 901, Leo tried to marry again, this time choosing his mistress, Zoe Karbonopsina, Zoe the Black-Eyed. At this, the patriarch Nicholas Mystikos balked. Even marrying three times was not exactly legal. An arcane bit of church doctrine said that while it was perfectly acceptable to marry again if your spouse died, you should only do it once. The patriarch had squinted at the third marriage, but he'd have had to close his eyes for the fourth, and this he was unwilling to do. Leo put up with this through the birth of Zoe's first baby, a girl. She became pregnant again at the beginning of 905. When she went into labor, Leo moved her into the porphyry-walled palace chamber where, by tradition, empresses gave birth to royal heirs. To be born in the purple chamber meant that the court had admitted you into its center, and the court of Constantinople was much more powerful as a whole than any single emperor. Emperors might and did come and go, writes the historian Arnold Toynbee. Able adventurers might and did oust an ephemeral dynasty, but the court lived on. Venerated by the court, the emperors of Constantinople were also hostage to the court's goodwill, and an emperor's power was only as great as the loyalty of his ministers and officers. Leo's court was loyal enough to support his quest for an heir, so Zoe delivered in the purple room, surrounded by the traditional attendants. Much to Leo's relief, her baby was a boy. Reaching for every strategy that might help legitimize his new son, the emperor gave him the hallowed royal name, Constantine. Both the name and the birth in the purple chamber were props to the baby's legitimacy, but to ensure his position beyond challenge, Leo still needed to marry his son's mother. He suggested again to the patriarch that he should wed for a fourth time. Again, the patriarch refused. Leo, theosophist that he was, decided that patriarchal permission was unnecessary and married Zoe anyway, in a lavish public ceremony that infuriated the senior churchmen of Constantinople. The mother was introduced into the palace, just like an emperor's wife, Nicholas Mystikos later wrote in a letter to Rome, and the very crown was set on the woman's head. The arch-priestly and priestly body was in uproar, as though the whole faith had been subverted. Despite his objections to the marriage, Nicholas Mystikos was essentially the emperor's man, but the loud yells of outrage from the other churchmen in Constantinople forced him to uphold the church's authority. Since Leo had defied the church, Nicholas Mystikos barred him, reluctantly, from entering the churches of his own city. This was unacceptable to Leo. In 907, he sent his soldiers to remove, by force and exile, not only Nicholas, but also the whole tier of priests who had objected to Zoe's installation as empress. Then, when Constantine reached the age of 6, Leo crowned him as co-emperor. He gave the little boy the royal name Constantine the 7th Porphyrogenitus, meaning purple-born, to remind everyone who approached the new emperor that the court had supported Constantine's right to inherit. He intended to make the succession as secure as possible before he died, because Byzantium was under hard pressure from the outside. For at least 2 centuries, the Islamic armies had been the greatest threat to Constantinople's safety. Now, the Abbasids were preoccupied with their own troubles, and the main locus of the threat had shifted west. The Bulgarian king Boris, who had presided over his country's formal conversion to Christianity, had been distant but cordial, and had even sent his son Simeon to be educated in Constantinople. But Simeon, once on the Bulgarian throne, turned into an enemy. Author's note, Boris abdicated in 889 and entered a monastery, leaving the throne to his older son Vladimir. Vladimir tried to reverse his father's policy on Christianity and started to drive out priests. Boris came out of the monastery, removed and jailed Vladimir, and crowned his younger son Simeon as his heir instead. Like Leo the Wise, Simeon was a reader. Nicholas Mystikos described him as a man whose love of knowledge led him to reread the books of the ancients, and his reading had fired his imagination. He wanted to turn Bulgaria into a great empire like the empires of old, and while Leo was absorbed by his marital troubles, Simeon was able to advance Bulgarian forces all the way to the walls of Constantinople. In 904, Leo had been forced to make a treaty giving the entire north of the Greek peninsula to Bulgaria, which made Simeon the emperor over almost all of the Slavic tribes in the lands now known as the Balkans. This had lifted one western threat, but another was approaching. In 906, the same year that Constantine Porphyrogenitus was confirmed as co-emperor, the Rus also pushed their way to the gates of Constantinople. The Rus had been growing in strength since their conversion. Their own accounts tell us that Rurik, the legendary Viking warrior who settled at Novgorod, had steadily spread his power among the surrounding peoples, and that when he died in 879, He left both his kingdom and the guardianship of his young son to another Rus nobleman, Oleg of Novgorod. Oleg took power for himself, and 3 years later moved the center of his power to Kiev. Since this same Oleg apparently was still alive and active 70 years later, most historians suspect that Oleg is a title rather than a personal name. The story reflects a general spread of Rus power under their warrior leaders. By the end of the 9th century, the Rus had forced the neighboring Slavic tribes to pay them tribute. The Russian Primary Chronicle lists a multitude of subjected peoples, including the eastern Slavic tribe of the Drevlians, who were forced to supply troops for the 906 attack on Constantinople, a total of 2,000 ships stuffed with men from 12 different nations. According to the colorful but unreliable chronicle, the Rus made wheels which they attached to the ships, and when the wind was favorable, they spread the sails and bore down upon the city from the open country. When the Greeks beheld this, they were afraid. Whatever terrified them, the people of Constantinople agreed to pay a huge tribute so that the Rus would retreat. A second treaty in 911 established a fragile peace, but the future looked grim to Leo. He died in 912, predicting on his deathbed that the empire would totter in the hands of his heirs. With Leo's death, his brother became senior emperor. Alexander, now 42, had been a crowned emperor without power for 33 years. He had spent most of his adult life drinking, hunting, and waiting for his brother to die, and his new authority went to his head. He was no fool. He dismissed Leo's court officers and recalled instead old Nicholas Mystikos, who was not likely to support any effort of the improperly born Constantine VII to usurp his uncle's authority. But then Alexander immediately announced that Constantinople would not pay the Bulgarian king Simeon I the yearly tribute Leo had promised. This defiance simply begged Simeon to descend on Byzantium and prove that he was no paper king. Simeon I took up the dare and doubled it. The historian Leo the Deacon writes that he sent a message to Constantinople demanding that the new emperor acknowledge that Simeon too was an emperor, Basileus of the Bulgarian people, and so equal in rank to Alexander himself. Alexander, of course, refused. Leo the Deacon is no fan of non-Greeks using the ancient and dismissive term for Bulgarians. He chalks Simeon's demand up to customary Scythian madness. But in fact, Simeon now had been not only cheated of his money, but also insulted, and so could justify to his own people the risk of besieging the great city itself. As he began to march towards Constantinople, Alexander, having started the fight, died. He had a stroke in the middle of a post-dinner game of ball on horseback, a sort of medieval polo, living only long enough to appoint Nicholas Mystikos as his young nephew's head regent. His death left the city in turmoil, ruled by a child and facing an approaching Bulgarian army led by a determined and insulted warrior king. The decision of how to deal with Simeon I was thus left to Constantine VII's Council of Regents, now headed by old Nicholas Mystikos. The Patriarch was still smarting over Leo's decision to overrule his judgment in favor of the popes, back when Constantine was a baby. Should Nicholas Mystikos admit, without reservation, that Constantine VII was legitimate, and therefore the rightful ruler of Constantinople, he would also be admitting that the Bishop of Rome had been right, and he had been wrong. Not a likely scenario. When Simeon I appeared outside the walls of Constantinople, Nicholas Mystikos found himself in an awkward position, supporting the rule of an emperor he thoroughly believed to be illegitimate. He agreed to admit Simeon to the city for a parley, and proposed a peace treaty. Byzantium would pay tribute to the Bulgarians, Constantine VII would agree to take one of Simeon's daughters as his wife, and he himself, the Patriarch of Constantinople, would crown Simeon as Emperor of the Bulgarians, Basileus, bearing the same authority, although only over his own people, as the Emperor of Byzantium. Undoubtedly, Nicholas Mystikos would have been much more reluctant to take this route, had he not firmly believed that Constantinople had no legitimate emperor. There was no harm in allowing Simeon I to take the title of emperor, since no one, in his view, actually held it at that particular moment. Constantine's mother, Zoe, was naturally appalled by the proposal, as were a good many of the soldiers and courtiers at Constantinople. Once Simeon was safely out of the gates, Zoe led a palace revolt, threw Nicholas Mystikos out of the palace. He remained regent, but she warned him to mind the business of the church and stay out of hers, and took control of the council. She then cancelled the entire peace treaty with Simeon. In revenge, Simeon embarked on a series of raids and attacks. He began to capture cities on the border between the two countries with increasing and worrying frequency. By 917, it was clear that the Byzantine army would have to launch a major strike against the Bulgarians. Constantine VII was still only 11, so the planning of the strike lay in Zoe's hands. She had two commanders to make use of: Leo Phocas, general of the Byzantine ground forces, and Romanos Lekapenus, admiral of the Byzantine navy. Romanos Lekapenus was a skilled officer, but he was also the son of a peasant and did not cut much of a figure in Byzantine society. Phocas, who was generally thought by army men to be a commander of limited talent, was a handsome aristocrat. But Liutprand of Cremona tells that he ardently desired to be made father of the emperor, and Zoe decided to entrust the attack to him. He marched his army north along the Black Sea coast to meet Simeon I and the Bulgarian army at Anchialus, on the shores of the Black Sea, while Romanos Lekapenus lay off the shore with his fleet. On August 20th, the two armies clashed. Accounts of the battle contradict each other, perhaps because most of the eyewitnesses died. The Battle of Anchialus was the bloodiest day of fighting in centuries. Almost all of Leo Phocas's officers and tens of thousands of regular soldiers fell. The battleground was unusable for decades afterwards because of the corpses stacked on it. According to Leo the Deacon, piles of bones still cluttered the field nearly 80 years later. The Bulgarians won the day, chasing the remnants of the Byzantine army southwards. Leo Phocas barely escaped. As for the Admiral Romanos Lekapenus, he ordered his ships to pull up anchor and retreated back into the safety of the Black Sea as soon as he realized the battle was lost. Leo Phocas tried to make another stand right outside Constantinople, but the Bulgarians massacred his remaining men a second time. By the time he managed to struggle back inside the city walls, Romanos Lekapenus was already there. He had sailed straight for the city, and now his fleet was anchored in the water nearby. Before Leo Phocas could explain his defeat, Romanos Lekapenus struck. He invited the city officials to board his flagship to discuss strategy, and then locked them in the hold, after which he marched into the city and removed Zoe and all of her supporters. He was practically unopposed,